Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonya Rappaport.
And today, Sonya, we begin Dark Phoenix Month with the 13th episode of Season 3, the 39th episode overall, the Dark Phoenix Saga Part 1, Dazzled.
Woo!
Are you excited to delve deep into one of the X-Men's greatest storylines ever?
I'm dazzled.
Wow, oh my god. This is the beginning of one of the most famous miniseries in this show's history. Arguably the most famous X-Men story of all time in general.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always counted the Phoenix and Dark Phoenix Saga as one story, not really as two separate ones. But,
yeah.
But people seem to like the Dark Phoenix Saga story more than the first one. Although it's all pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fortuitous timing that we're just getting to this episode right now. Because last week, the first promotional, images and stories about the new Dark Phoenix X-Men movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like there's some Dark Phoenix fever going on in the world of entertainment.
We've been real lucky in the world of X-Men.
What do you mean?
We could not have planned out our timing better to coincide with all these X-Men anniversaries and things that have been happening lately.
Well, to be fair, the best timing was that it was the 25th anniversary when we started the show.
That's what I'm
and
talking
that
about.
Was totally random.
Yeah.
But this Dark Phoenix timing, it's it'd be more of a magical moment if the movie was coming out this weekend. But it's just the first promotional, so. But still interesting timing nonetheless.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yes, we will take it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that and some other X-Men movie news at the end of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But let us delve right into this episode. Maybe take another half step back before we do that.
False advertising. Yeah.
I tweeted out last night that I was doing some studying for these episodes by reading the original Dark Phoenix comics.
Yeah, I saw that.
In my Marvel Masterworks collections.
Uh-huh.
And I got through 40% of it before I fell asleep in the bed.
See, I'm not the only one.
Sorry.
It's not because they aren't interesting.
Yeah.
It's just they're really relaxing for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't straight up pass out in the book. I kind of made this calculated decision. I was really tired. I was like, well, I don't need to read the entire 15 comics in a row here. We're only doing the first episode tomorrow, so I only need to refresh myself a little bit.
Mm.
And that's not even necessarily, even as I was reading, I was like, this isn't necessarily really relevant to the cartoon, but it's related, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, we get an interesting credit note, that Chris, they based the story off Chris Claremont's original story.
Mm-hmm.
He is the X-Men guru from the 70s and 80s into the 90s a little bit, and he was responsible for all the X-Men stories we know and love, the classic ones that they've based all the movies on for the most part.
Yep.
So he's X-Men writer honcho number one. So it's cool that they give him some credit here.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, just some general impressions reading the comic. How it differs a bit from the animated series. When you read the classic Chris Claremont era of X-Men, it's such more of a wider sweep and so much more ambitious than what they can do in the cartoon. And that, on one hand, that's obvious because a comic can go into way more detail than the cartoon can.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also kind of, it was a little refreshing to read the Dark Phoenix Saga, because it's not just about what's going on with Jean. There's all these other amazing adventures that he just weaves in, with the introduction of Kitty Pryde and Spider-Man drops by with Arcade, the villainous assassin guy that looks like a short Conan O'Brien or something, and a lot of awesome Moira MacTaggert's son with Proteus, which actually becomes X-Men cartoons later, I think. Proteus is in season 4. I might be wrong. Maybe it's at the end of season 3.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, it's all this stuff is going on. The X-Men are flying around the world. Half the X-Men think the other half are dead.
Mm-hmm.
They had this battle with Magneto, and there's an explosion or something, and Beast and Jean and maybe Professor X were on one side of the explosion, and the other X-Men with Cyclops and Storm and Colossus were on the other, and both thought they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
Each other were dead. So there's many comics that go by where they're going through the grief of the X-Men being half dead.
Right.
So it's all this crazy stuff going on, and And generally, I'll say, not to harp on them too much, most of our fans have probably looked at them or are familiar with them. But, like, you know, the cartoon is great. Obviously, we're huge fans. But the one thing the comics do better is that they have a lot more, like, in-depth characterization than what the cartoons are capable of.
Well, they have, like, unlimited time to stretch out the stories as long as they want.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. And they have thought bubbles and, you know, things of that nature.
A lot of inner monologues.
Right. And yeah, a lot more soap opera stuff. And it's and the only thing I'm really going to say about that is that the character of Jean Grey in the comics is more interesting than what she is in the cartoon by far.
Hmm.
And by that I mean it's like, in the comics, it's really the story of a young woman. You know, they pretty clearly peg her in her, like, early 20s, like 23, 24, who is, like, young and alive and, like, still discovering herself in the world. And she's, like, got a lot of emotions. It's, like, very true to a person in their young 20s, mm-hmm, a lot of it. And the other thing, like, it made me think, it's, like, you know, a big thing that how they set up the Dark Phoenix saga in the comic is that Jean doesn't even realize she's susceptible to all this power.
Mm.
Because it's, like, very nicely played against the fact that she's a young woman, you know, growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's like when you're that age, you can't – sometimes you maybe can't tell the difference between, like, experiencing all these great new things and how you're changing as a person.
That's really nuanced. That's crazy. Especially when you think about that these comics were written with a kid audience in mind who don't have the perspective to look on it that way, you know?
Like, well, I mean, I certainly read them, you know, I'm not a child of the 70s. I'm a child of the 90s. But I read them as a kid.
Yeah.
And I didn't obviously catch that nuance. I just thought, right, it was, like, great, cool characters and great stories. But you're right. It's like there's incredible, like, that's why Chris Claremont's, like, considered a legend in the business.
Yeah.
Because he was just a great writer, and he put all this, like, he put all his layering into X-Men, and he made it, I mean, he's one of the guys that's responsible for making Marvel what it is today. He put, like, the adult layers into it. He put the meaning into it. He did all the work, like, all those, you know, his, like, 15-year peak that he was on, like, all that he put in there, that was, like, he turned X-Men into the best-selling comic, you know, into the most popular Marvel franchise. He eclipsed Spider-Man, and that's, like, a large part thanks to him and the artists I was working with, and why, like, adults, like, really kept on with comics into their adulthood, too, because it was interesting, you know, and he influenced so many filmmakers and screenwriters, you know, like, Quentin Tarantino and Joss Whedon, and, like, probably even, like, those are, like, the most famous examples that they loved, you know, the X-Men from the 70s and things like that. But anyway, like, yeah, so, I mean, this is why it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And why they're making a second iteration of a Phoenix movie after they messed it up the first time,
right,
like, the early 2000s.
Well, yeah. I'll just say, to circle back to the characterization,
yeah,
characterization of Jean, it's, like, nice to know that she's, like, really well developed in the comics, because that's always been my criticism of her character in this show.
Yeah.
Is that she's just
very bland.
Very, yeah, exactly. It's very, bleh. And it's like she doesn't really come to life until they give her the Phoenix story arc.
Yeah, definitely.
And even at that point, it's like that's the thing that she's known for is, right, like, being the Phoenix
and
all those other parts of her personality.
Right. And it's also, like, because she becomes the Phoenix and the storyline is so interesting,
yeah,
it makes you care about Jean in the cartoon more than you would have otherwise.
Right.
Because you just know about the comics and how, like, what a big deal it is. So it's like taking, it's like they're almost like asking the audience to, like, be more invested in the character of Jean than we otherwise would be if you were just, like, purely basing it off the cartoon. And the other thing I want to say, it's like, shout out to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, because, you know, the original...
Not that we need to shout them out here.
No, but, like, I was reading these comics last night, and I was thinking, like, you know, the original X-Men series in the 60s was canceled, and there's a lot of reasons why. Like, for one thing, like, the stories were pretty, like, you know, ho-hum in a lot of ways, and the characters were a bit ho-hum. I mean, they created, like, an excellent concept, excellent powers, colorful characters with a lot of potential, but basically all the teenagers of the X-Men, Beast, Iceman, Angel, Cyclops, and Jean, and Professor X, I mean, a lot of, well, Professor X is a different story, but, like, they were all, like, blocks of wood, like, your everyday 60s white teen person,
mm-hmm,
with, like, very little going on. However, I would say that when Chris Claremont inherited the series and they relaunched it in the 70s because it was canceled for a few years there. It's like, that was actually a pretty good template to, like, to work from. Because I was thinking that, like, a lot of teenagers are blank slates.
Yeah.
You know, they are, like, hunks of wood. They can't reflect, they don't have a life experience to reflect on in any meaningful way. Mm-hmm. You just kind of, when you're a teenager, you just take things as they come. Yeah. And you're, whatever little set of uniqueness you have, you're just ready to, like, go at it at the world. But as you get a little older, into your 20s, your real, like, adult personality starts to take hold, and the choices you make have more serious and more serious consequences. Mm-hmm. So it's like there was something, like, natural about the way that they evolved from, like, this sort of bland 60s white teenagers, like, you know, wearing suits and ties, mm-hmm. into these, like, interesting 70s outrageous characters that are all, like, fighting with each other and, like, really, like, diving in deep into craziness. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, like, in a weird way, it's like, you know, Stan and Jack did a good job of just setting the template. You know, it's like, give us a good blank slate with, like, a really, like, beautiful premise, and then, and people like Chris Claremont can carry it on forward, and it's like, it's never stopped making money. So, I mean, here we are today talking about it with a lot of enthusiasm. So, all right, so that's all the preamble to this episode. So let's just dive in deep here, as I promised 10 minutes ago. But anyway, so it opens on Muir Island. We see Moira MacTaggert, Banshee, and Professor X all working with Jean in some kind of futuristic lab. And they're trying to... The problem right away is they're trying to excise the Phoenix from Jean's consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it's really not going that well.
No. Well, they reveal that they've had her in some kind of therapy that, like, calms her down.
It's like,
am I jumping ahead too much?
No. It's like psychoneural therapy.
Right.
Which is crazy. Is that a thing? Seems kind of like redundant. Like psychoneural. Like they're both talking about the mind. Whatever. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, but they, it's not like actually meaningful in like extricating the Phoenix from Jean. So basically Moira's like, all right, just go home and like...
Well, you're jumping the gun in the sense it's like more bad therapy from Professor X and crew. Because not only is this therapy bad, Jean causes a massive explosion in this lab.
Right.
Like, they show an exterior shot of Moira's lab exploding in a massive fireball, but then luckily everyone's okay.
Yeah.
Somehow
they survive.
Yeah, so it's like every time Professor X tries some kind of therapy, it always backfires.
This wasn't Professor X, though. This was Moira.
Yeah, it was both of them. They're, like, working together.
Right.
I'm going to attribute that definitely, like, half to Professor X. But anyway, it's pretty, like, messed up. Like, it's a desperate situation. Jean's, you know, really struggling here. She's, I mean, they establish right away that this Phoenix entity is, like, another entity.
Yeah.
It's like she's got a split personality now.
Yeah.
And to an extent, that's what the Phoenix Force is. It's this, like, cosmic force that's inhabited the body of Jean Grey.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's like, in the first Phoenix saga, you're not, like, too sure. Like, you think it's all Jean for the most part, and she just gets these powers.
Right.
You don't think it's, like, this other entity with, like, a personality. Right. Did you get that? I mean, yeah. A little bit.
Yeah, I think you get the sense that it's another entity. You don't get, like...
But they're working in concert together so well that for good, you know, they saved the galaxy.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like, it's not like, it wasn't like to this extent. Like, there, it wasn't like, now it's like...
Well, they're also united in a common purpose.
Right.
So it's harder to distinguish which character traits are genes and which ones are the Phoenix.
Right.
In that, like, first story arc there. But anyway...
I mean, she's still stuck in that costume, too.
Right.
So, in the meantime, we go back to New York City, and Cyclops and Gambit are on some kind of, like, bizarre night mission, where they're visiting...
I don't think they're on a mission. I think they're just, like, out at a club.
It's difficult to say. So this is another thing pulled from the comics. Like, this is why the comics are so great, because as this Phoenix saga was going on, there'd be all these new adventures, and, like, one of them was Dazzler.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about the Dazzler comic, you know, if it's a very iconic comic book cover, and it shows Dazzler in her disco outfit, like, exploding on the stage, and...
Yeah, if you don't know, Dazzler is a mutant, but also a singer.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the point of Dazzler, the Marvel is very consciously trying to launch a disco superhero, and it failed, like, right away. Dazzler was quickly buried. I mean, although they never really got rid of the character, she comes back. Most famously in the X-Men arcade video game.
Right.
But, I mean, and she, you know, has, like, many times in the comics she appears and reappears. But, like, as they were really trying to make some kind of disco phenomenon with her. I don't even know, like... I vaguely now, as I'm talking about it, I remember that they even want to record a record, like hire some singer to be Dazzler. Mm-hmm. And you had a very funny point about this. You were mentioning something about Jem and the Holograms while we were watching
it. Oh, yeah, that's right. I was like, they should have just gotten Jem to be, like, the performer, you know? Because, like, in the show, they don't, you know, the staff writers, I guess, don't want to be writing, like, pop songs, like, full-length pop songs for the show, because it's not a good use of, like, their airtime, like, their limited airtime
right,
for storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. These episodes are really crammed tight with story that you can't have a song.
Right, but it's, like, it's funny.
We get like 1.5 seconds of a song.
That's the thing. That's what I was going to say is like you only get like 1 or 2 seconds of Dazzler like finishing up some song.
Don't you want to hear the whole thing?
Kind of sounds cruddy. Yeah. You know, it's like they should just use Jem. Jem well, and the Holograms.
And I laugh because, first of all, I'm almost 99% certain Jem and the Holograms, the cartoon from the 1980s, about a magical rock band with the lead singer. She wears holographic earrings. That's a whole other story. A whole other podcast.
It's not a mutant power. It's just it's just the thing.
It's just fucking crazy. Science. Yeah. Jem, that was a Marvel production.
Yeah.
An animated Marvel production, which is really cool. I don't think it was a Marvel comic because that show was cooked up. It was based off a toy line.
Right.
I think they outsourced to Marvel like studios to do the animation.
Yeah.
And that show has some ridiculously insane animation.
Yes.
That's
like a super psychedelic show.
Yeah, it's really insane.
It's not
insane.
Disco psychedelic, but yeah. It's like sorry, go ahead.
No, I don't know. I was saying that, like, I read somewhere recently that Larry Houston, you know, the famous director from this show, yeah. I think he was involved with Jem and the Holograms, too. Oh, maybe okay. Some other, like, X-Men artists from this show.
I mean, when you watch the two of them, it's definitely...
similar style.
Yeah, like, the cadence or something of the episodes kind of go by in the same way. I would say that,
that's
like,
funny.
This season, anyway, of X-Men has... better animation, like more seamless animation than Jem and the Holograms does for the most part.
Right. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I mean, because it's a little more... Jem and the Holograms is a bit more stiff in the, like, dialogue segments. But when it comes to the music segments of Jem and the Holograms,
yeah,
they're crazy.
Yeah, the music segments are, like...
way better animated than the
X-Men. Super psychedelic, like, music videos, each and every one of them. But, like, when it comes to actual storytelling and dialogue, like, a lot of the character movements in that show are kind of, like, jerky or something.
Right.
Which, like, yeah, isn't really a problem
it's
season.
It's cheap, and that's a hallmark of Marvel when
it comes to
animation.
Yeah, right. Anyway, like, not to go too deep into Jem and the Holograms here, but...
I would love to, though.
Definitely. That's your next podcast,
though. No, I would never do that. Although I really enjoyed that show.
I don't think I could watch
the theme song alone drives you crazy.
Yes, it does. Anyway, but that would have been like a funny like little crossover cameo.
In a way, we kind of get it.
Yeah.
And my point I was going to make by even mentioning Dazzler compared to the comics was that, like I said, there's all these like other adventures like percolating while the Phoenix Saga bubbles in the background, and Dazzler is one of them. So the cartoon has like a stab at that here. It's like, oh, we're meeting a new character out of nowhere, and isn't that interesting? A new location, a new situation.
Yeah.
But in this episode, the whole Dazzler thing, much like the comic, is like almost like an afterthought. Like, she's not... It's
well,
not that
no,
big of a
I
deal.
Mean, in this episode, it's that it, like, feeds into the storyline with Jean
very directly
at the end of the episode.
Yeah,
so.
But it's not like... It's not like...
But
we're going
like
to dive deep into Dazzler.
No, but they, like, give her a purpose that's still serving, like, the Phoenix arc. It's not really, really, like, a little side adventure,
right.
You know, because it's still connected.
It's a hint at, like, a grander adventure, you know? And it's like, the comics can show you a hint of a grander adventure and take you on an adventure.
Right.
The cartoon can only briefly show it to you in flashes.
I'm fine with that, though.
No, I'm fine with that, too. I'm just saying that's my point. It's, like, the difference between the cartoon and the comic. Anyway. So, they're at this club, this New York City nightclub, watching Dazzler, and Cyclops, he bails early. He's still, like, upset about Jean. And we're finally, with the Dark Phoenix Saga, obviously we're connecting between the end of the Phoenix Saga, those middle episodes where they don't really address it that much.
Yeah.
And now we're back, like, the characters are finally trying to resolve all these feelings.
Right.
So in a way, that's, like, a good, that they're, like, they're picking up that beat again.
Well, the reason... Actually, I mean, timeline-wise, you can kind of assume that Jean has been in, like, this psychoneural therapy, whatever they call it, on Muir Island this whole time while the X-Men have been up to their regular business.
Yeah.
But the reason that Cyclops actually gets up and leaves the club is that he gets, like, a psychic signal from Jean that she's in trouble and she needs his help.
They share a psychic bond.
Even though they're... their bond is not deeper than love.
Or is it?
It's just regular love.
I was going to go there with the bond deeper than love theme. No one seems to be responding to it. But yeah, they do have a bond deeper than love.
How do you know? I think their bond is just regular love, plus Gene's a psychic.
I don't think I'd be happy if you had psychic powers.
I don't think I'd be happy if I had psychic powers.
I don't think, like, the idea that, like, I'm like, we live in a world where we have cell phones, so if you need to reach out to me from across the great distance, thank God, you could just call me. But anyway, so Scott, he leaves the club, leaves Gambit, and then he notices that there's a kidnapping going on in the back alley, and Dazzler's being, like, manhandled by this weird Ponzi man. In like 19th or 18th century outfit and some weird like red and purple faced goons. Mm-hmm. And this guy is Pierce, and he's the first member of the Hellfire Club that we meet. Excuse me, not the Hellfire Club, the Circle Club.
Yeah.
Edited for children's broadcasting.
Right.
So, I mean, that's not too much of a... that's
whatever.
Fine, yeah.
They like explain it away in like one line, you know, when they like first... enter into the Circle Club. He says something. I forget what the line is exactly. He says something about like, and only members can join the circle.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that's like a good substitute actually for Hellfire Club.
Yeah,
it's kind of like it's like a nice. It's almost like it's not pandering in a way. It's like how they had to change Brotherhood of Evil Mutants in the movies to Brotherhood of Mutants. Mm-hmm. Because who would identify themselves as evil, really?
Right. You know? Just makes sense.
Yeah. So here it's like, you know, it's like, why would you want to call yourself the Hellfire Club? That's kind of bizarre.
Well, Hell's Angels name themselves that.
That's true, yeah. But,
sometimes you need
but they're
to, like,
the angels of hell.
Project your badass element, persona.
Yeah, but there's an element of good with the Hell's Angels. Whereas here, it's like the Hellfire. There's nothing good about Hellfire. Who wants to be in Hellfire and be in a club about it?
Maybe you want to be so tough that you can withstand the fires of hell.
I guess. I perhaps. But anyway, here they're the Circle Club. So this guy, Pierce, he's kidnapping Dazzler. Cyclops sees this, and he starts trying to save her. And Pierce, it turns out, has this like bizarrely powerful cybernetic arm. You know, he doesn't have a human arm, he's got a robot arm, and that's his one great power.
Yeah.
And it's actually surprisingly dangerous and effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he reaches into Dazzler's Porsche or something and pulls out the engine with one hand and throws it at Cyclops. And Cyclops explodes it with this optic blast, but he's being showered with engine explosion, which is pretty dangerous for him. But then Dazzler saves him, so she sort of reveals herself to be a mutant in this moment.
Right.
Although she was kind of doing it on stage before, briefly.
Yeah.
So her powers, I always loved her powers as a kid. I don't know, it makes no sense, like, as an adult or in general. Her power is that she can, like, convert sound energy into light.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be part of her gimmick as a performer,
mm-hmm.
that as she's singing her song, she's taking all the sound energy and making it into this, like, psychedelic light show.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, to dazzle audiences, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then, but I guess, like, the idea is she's kind of like Jubilee, where this light energy can be used forcefully.
Right.
I'm not quite sure. Like, I mean, they kind of show her blinding people more than they, like, show it as laser beams.
Oh, I thought it was, like, pretty much just, like, Jubilee.
It probably is. I don't really know. A Facebook group inform us about the powers of Dazzler. I know, like, she had some, like, other... She has some, like, other insane, like, time-traveling power or something, too. Like, they did more to her as it went along. They did something with her powers.
All right.
But, like, I think, like, she was not a popular character from the comic book audience. She was pretty, like, lame and wimpy.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I don't know.
Days of Disco were past.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
the writers just didn't know their audience.
It is a combination. Like, the comic came out, I think, in 79, so Disco was already waning at that point. And
yeah.
I feel like a lot of the comic audience wasn't interested in Disco. They'd be on, like, the Disco sucks side of that whole culture war that was going on then.
Yeah.
You know, a bunch of, like, you know, pimply teenage boys, for the most part, not caring too much. But who knows?
Okay.
I mean, that's actually an unfair stereotype, because I think a lot of X-Men's fans were women. And gay people, too, who historically...
may or may not have been into disco.
Exactly, right. All right, so anyway, really bringing up stereotypes and busting them as we speak. So anyway, Scott rescues Dazzler. She's really impressed by Scott, and she's, like, kind of really flirty with him right away. And I like this moment, too, because Scott, like, awkwardly... He's not trying to hit on her, but in a weird clumsy way he is.
Yeah.
He's just kind of like bumblingly saying like, I would like to talk to you about your mutant powers.
Yeah.
And wink, wink.
He doesn't wink though.
No, he doesn't
wink. It just sounds like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cyclops does not have the benefit of winking socially, actually.
No. Oh yeah, that's true.
So that's like a element, right? They're establishing that like, oh, you know, there might be some, you know,
well, you get that, like, tension. She's interested in him.
Right.
Even though he's not, like, romantically interested in her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, like, later that night, Cyclops returns home, Wolverine slicing salami very dramatically. And he's talking to Cyclops is talking to Wolverine about Dazzler. And this is a funny moment where...
Sorry, I'm still laughing at the salami. I forgot about that.
Yeah. That's pretty funny, right?
Yeah.
There's a moment where Cyclops is like, I met this... See, this is where I think he might have something for Dazzler.
All right.
He's like, I met this woman named Dazzler. She's so intriguing. And Wolverine's like, shh, quiet. Because Jean walks right in the door at that moment.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like Wolverine was trying to, like, protect Cyclops from embarrassing himself or revealing too much in front of, you know, his fiancée, Jean. Right? Did you get that sense a little bit? Like, why is he so quick to silence Cyclops?
I thought there was something else happening at the time, and
no.
Now I can't remember it.
This moment always stuck out to me for years.
Huh.
So I just always thought it was funny that Wolverine's trying to be Cyclops' bro in that moment, despite him having a, you know, a crush in his girlfriend as well.
I don't think it's because he's trying to protect Cyclops. I think Wolverine himself is just, like, really surprised to see Jean because they haven't seen her in a long time. So, like, she walks into the room and, like, everything stops for him.
That's,
you know?
True. That's true. But it also was a little odd, though, because he says, shh, you know, puts his finger up to his mouth. And it's just, I don't know. I thought that was a strange moment.
All right.
But, yeah, so Jean's back in the X-Mansion. She's really weird and insane. Like, her whole brain's, like, half scooped out, basically.
Yeah, despondent.
And Cyclops isn't happy about it. He says, you know, she goes to bed, Storm takes her to bed, and Cyclops is like, she's distant, and I don't know what's wrong with her, and what's going to happen?
That's really funny, actually, because he says something about, like, it's been weeks of therapy, and she's still not better. I was like, I don't think that's how any therapy really works.
I mean, yeah, she, like, just flew to the center of the sun, man.
Yeah, like, you know, weeks is, that's a tall order.
Yeah. So, you know, Jean's not doing great, but now we get to meet more of the Circle Club. The Hellfire Club. I'm going to call it the Hellfire Club. That's just what it is. I'm sorry.
Take your stand.
Yeah. So, like the guy Pierce, everyone in the Hellfire Club wears this, like, poncy outfits from the 1700s or something.
So weird.
Yeah. So, we've got Sebastian Shaw, the leader, and his power is to absorb the power of other mutants, mainly, or energy in general, and he's kind of unstoppable in a weird way. And he's very, he's like, I think he's, in the comics I was reading last night that he, someone mentions that he's this, like, famous industrialist, too. And then you've got Pierce, the guy with the metal arm, and then this, like, fatter dude, Leland, who is always a great character, especially in the Phoenix saga. He's got the power of, like, gravity, where if he just points at you, you sink to the ground. And we'll see that, like, famously used in this episode and pulled from the comics. And then also we have Jason Wingard, who is secretly, spoilers, Master Mold in disguise. So Master Mold is one of the original members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. He's, like, this really ugly, like, wretched old man who – well, he's not too old. He's, like, in his 60s, maybe 50s. And he's just really ugly. He's got warts and stuff. And he wears, like, this brown, like, ugly coat. And his whole power is illusion. So he's not quite like a psychic like Professor X, but it's close. Like, he can make people think, like, illusions are real that are going on in the room. So very famously in one of his first issues, Master Mold turns, like, let's say, Beast's legs into jelly or something, and Beast can't move. And even though Beast says, I know it's an illusion, but I still can't move my legs.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's how incredibly powerful his powers are in a sense. But in another sense, he's really pathetic, too, because... Here he is. One of the cool things about bringing Master Mold, why did I call him Master Mold? Mastermind. Did I call him Master Mold before?
Yeah.
Okay, Mastermind.
You're on a roll, though. I didn't want to stop you.
That's fine, yeah. I'm glad I caught that. Mastermind, one of the cool things about bringing him back in the comics and in this cartoon, well, he wasn't shown in the cartoon earlier, is he's reinvented. So he's got this whole new persona and this look, and he uses his power to make himself look like this young, virile, handsome man.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses his good looks to seduce Jean Grey. So he's central to the Dark Phoenix plot.
Right.
Because he uses his illusions to help push her over the edge and drive her crazy.
Right.
So he's in the Hellfire Club. And also Emma Frost, the White Queen, that she makes her introduction to. And she's a bizarre character.
Yes.
So Emma Frost is like one of those, like, it was like a totally weak-ass, whack X-Men villain, in my opinion anyway, when she debuted in these issues. Mm-hmm. First of all, her name, the White Queen, is insane. Mm-hmm. And that name comes from, it's like, that's her role in the Hellfire Club. Mm-hmm. Later, spoilers again, we'll see Jean, she'll become the Black Queen.
Yeah.
You know, so, I don't know, like, what's going on with that, if it's, like, has something to do with playing cards, or just, like, their weird ancient rituals or something.
Oh.
But, so she's the White Queen, but as a queen, she wears, like, a corset.
And underpants.
Yeah, and like, yeah.
And a long flowing cape.
Yeah. And then through the years, they make her even sexier. Like, in the 70s version, she's wearing lingerie, which I guess was kind of scandalous at the time.
Uh-huh.
But, like, they up the lingerie factor to, like, another level throughout the 80s and 90s. They make her more scandalous.
Wow.
As it goes on. And, like I said, she's kind of like a whack-ass mutant at first. She's got psychic power. She's nowhere near as powerful as Jean or the Professor.
Mm-hmm.
Her powers manifest a little differently, shown in the comics and in the cartoon. Like, she can blast some green laser bolts, which I guess is psychic energy or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just, like, a real, like, hammy, like, Disney villainess.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Cruella de Vil or something.
Yeah.
Of that vein. But the interesting thing about Emma Frost is that they totally, like, change her around in the comics as the years go by. I think it was all Grant Morrison's doing.
Oh, really?
It might have been a little bit before him, but basically,
like, the turning to diamond?
Yeah, like, yeah. That's part of it.
Oh, that was him?
So that's her secondary mutation she gets in the early 2000s, and she can turn her body into, like, unbreakable diamond substance. She can't use her psychic powers when that's happening. But anyway, that's not even the interesting part. The interesting part, she becomes a good guy. She works for the X-Men.
Right.
And she ends up being responsible for breaking up Scott and Jean's marriage in the comics, which is, like, one of the greatest storylines. It really, like, Grant Morrison really understood that the X-Men was this amazing soap opera.
Yeah.
And, like, you have to keep messing with everyone. You can't let them be happy. So, and Emma Frost is this, like, she's this hilarious, he turns all of her campiness, it works so much better as a good guy.
Mm.
Because when she's on the side of the good, it's just, like, really funny that a character that was fighting for good would be this ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way she involves herself with the X-Men's lives and her opinions are really insane. And she's kind of like, she's got a really, like, she still has an evil streak in her, even though she's turned to good.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, and it's just, like, a really interesting character. So, but here in the traditional form, as she's shown in the cartoon, the comic, she's kind of sucks. But nonetheless, sort of intriguing. So that's the Hellfire Club. We've met them. What else was I going to say about this? You know, and then, like, for kids who missed the Phoenix Saga, Emma Frost somehow knows everything about it, and she recaps the whole story.
Right. You, like, are led to believe that it's because she's psychic, so she, like, somehow gleaned the information from Jean or something.
But she reveals she hacked Professor X's computer system, which I guess is Cerebro.
Right.
And she said he's been too distracted. So it's like a combination of being a psychic and a computer hacker.
Right.
So some more bizarre computer hacking, a very convenient plot device in the X-Men universe.
Or does she just, I don't know if computer hacking is it, maybe, like, because she's psychic, that's why she's able to hack into Cerebro.
It's like a combination. Like, yeah. I was very, like, watching it closely to see what you were talking about, but they say it's both, pretty much.
Right, okay.
So it's bizarre. You one doing computer hacking with your mind, that's actually, like, a good premise for a movie. It's kind of, is that The Matrix? Maybe, never mind. So, meanwhile, Phoenix is still recovering. She's not doing well, or Jean, whatever. She's still recovering, and she asks Storm to get her some water. Actually, right before that, she's, like, blasting energy out of her eyeballs and mouth.
Yeah, it's funny how everyone around her remains calm. Like, the professor is in
the
room.
As calm as it can be.
And, like, yeah. Scott and Storm are around, and, like, all of a sudden she just becomes filled with rage, and, like, her eyes glaze over with yellow light, and then it's, like, just pouring out of all of her, like, facial orifices.
Yeah, it reminded me of Janosch from Ghostbusters 2. Yeah. There's a scene where Viggo like shoots the electricity into his eyeballs.
Yeah,
it was kind of like that. And then there's like a later scene where Janosch uses his eyeballs as light bulbs or something.
Right.
I mean,
it's just crazy because everyone's like sitting around her and they're like remaining calm and they're like, "You have to fight it, Jean," and like she's blasting.
Yeah,
like,
there's something seriously wrong with her. It's not just like a matter of getting over a traumatic event.
Right. But anyway, she gets it under control more or less for a little bit.
It's kind of funny how they don't think that like they need a straight up exorcism here.
Well, that they how have are they to draw. Do that, though?
I don't know, but they're all like just trying to say like, "Well, you've got these phoenix powers now. You're just gonna have to learn to live with them." Instead of just saying like, "We have to like set up some kind of like thing where we draw the phoenix out with like, you know, like in Stranger Things right. we saw, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, like entice it in some way,
yeah,
or
yeah,
set a trap or something."
I guess that's out of the question in that sense. But like, also meanwhile, speaking of Stranger Things and like weird. Like exorcisms, the circle, the Hellfire Club is doing a seance in their quarters, and it's their plan is they want the Phoenix's power on their side.
Yeah.
So they, you know, it's Mastermind and
Emma Frost,
like in a seance, like they enter Jean's mind.
Well, basically, like, Emma Frost can enter Jean's mind because she's psychic. Right. But then, like, while she's holding hands with Mastermind,
yeah.
he, like, can, like, use that
the illusion.
Psychic power as, like, a channel to, like, put his illusions into Jean's mind
you
or
would,
something.
You would think that Emma Frost would have all the powers of Mastermind.
Right.
You
to
know
be
what
able
mean?
To, like, form those illusions.
Yeah, especially because it's not, like, the original, like I mentioned before, the conceit of Mastermind was the illusions he creates are in, like, the waking world in a three-dimensional space.
Right.
It's not like he's not entering people's minds directly. I don't know how he's doing it. The point is it's all confusing and it makes no sense. But he's not a psychic like Emma Frost is.
Right.
So, right, she's the channel that he uses for yeah. his illusions. So maybe it's all amplified between the two of them.
Well, but part of the thing is that they want it to be stealthy. Like, they don't want Jean to know that they're creating an illusion for her. So, like, they're doing it that
right.
way.
Okay, I like
I
your
guess,
explanation.
Right,
yeah.
because like they're creating this illusion while she's sleeping.
Right.
So for
so
her,
Emma's,
it feels like a dream.
Right.
But it feels like super realistic to the point where she like doesn't realize that she's dreaming. At some point,
right.
she like thinks it's her real life.
So it's like Emma surreptitiously opening a door in Jean's mind without doing anything.
Right.
But Master Mold is the one feeding his intense power through.
Right.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. So, and this is from the comics too. Mastermind, aka Jason Wingard, he creates this elaborate illusion all set in the, like, 18th century where he's this, like, dashing, like, rich rogue of the high seas. And he's... Him and Jean are caught up in like a trashy romance novel.
Yeah.
On a boat.
Just the two of them.
Yeah. In the comics, it goes like a step further towards the world of edginess
uh-huh.
because all the illusions have this really like messed up dark undertone to them. Like, for instance, in one of them, they're like out like hunting together on horseback. And you think, oh, it's just traditional like, you know, rich people hunting with hounds in the English woods.
Yeah.
But in reality, they're like, they're hunting. Like a man,
uh-huh.
like wearing antlers, like a creepy rich person activity.
Ooh, that is creepy.
Yeah, and then in the comic, Jason Wingard's like, "This was such a great idea of yours, Jean, to the idea to hunt man. What a clever sport you are," or
Ooh.
Something. Yeah, and she's like, "What? This was my idea? I guess so."
Wow, it's really dark.
Yeah, like he's pushing her to the dark side.
Right.
In like that weird way. And there's like other instances of that too.
Uh-huh.
Like he's really like tantalizing her dark, like sexual, sensual side. In a way that, like, you know, Cyclops can't do.
Right.
So that's what's going on. So but here it's, like, a little more sanitized. She's just on, like, a boat with him, and it's romantic in that sense.
Uh-huh.
And they're kind of, like, summarizing the story in general. This goes on for several comics in the books.
Right.
In the cartoon, they speed it up a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
So, but meanwhile, like, this is driving Jean crazy. So she asks Storm to get her a cup of water. And in the meantime, she burns her bed and flies out the window to meet, presumably, with Jason Wingard.
Right.
And Storm's really shocked. Actually, no. Jean flies to the nightclub to confront
Scott.
Scott.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because she wakes up.
Right,
and
yeah.
she realizes that she was actually dreaming.
Yeah, because Scott is still, like, anchoring.
But she's like, oh, it's, like, so strong. Yeah. Like, it felt like real life. And then she, like, has that psychic bond with Scott, so she goes to find him.
Right.
To, like, get comforted, basically.
And when she lands in the alleyway outside the nightclub, she's in her dark red Phoenix outfit.
Yeah.
We see that for the first time.
Right. But then she gets back to her normal, like, casual wear.
Clothing, yeah. So, that's what's going on. I want to mention, too, like, just talk about the Hellfire Club again briefly. I really just like the idea of it.
Uh-huh.
I know that they're wearing ridiculous outfits and stuff.
I mean, who are we to judge? The X-Men are wearing ridiculous outfits, too. Just
yeah.
different genre.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm just saying, like, it's a clever idea that it's a circle of rich people. Powerful rich people who are also mutants.
Yeah.
So, it's I just like that line of logical thinking that there's mutants in this world and that some of them are going to be from the upper crust,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, and they themselves would be, you know, not necessarily using their powers for good. Some of them do, like Angel. He's a rich guy.
And so is Professor X.
Yeah, he's a rich guy. Right, yeah. So they use their powers for good. But some of these mutants are, like, they form this, like, you know, weird upper crust secret society.
Yeah.
With their own, you know, plans to dominate the world.
Something kind of realistic about that.
Yeah, there's like, it's like a clever, like, it's like a good story writing touch, you know? And the fact that the club is so exclusive. In the comics, I think they make a big deal that, like, celebrities are in the club. You know, because no one really knows what the inner circle's all about.
Mm.
To be in the inner circle, you need to be an evil mutant, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but on the lower levels, like...
Sounds like Scientology.
Maybe. That's a funny... Let's not go there.
Okay.
And, like, the lower levels, there's, like, celebrities and people to know and business tycoons and stuff. You know, it's kind of... Like, there's stuff like that in the real world too,
uh-huh.
where there's, like, really snooty private clubs that, like, you don't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, like, the... one example is, like, the Augusta Golf Club. You know, like, the Masters, that competition they have every year, it's, like, uh-huh. the ultimate golf competition.
Yeah.
You know, the people that win the green jacket they get a green jacket as their prize.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, like, the actual members of the club aren't golfers. They're, like, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and, like, other rich, snooty people.
So they just go there to, like, watch golf and, like, socialize?
Yeah, it's, like, the ultimate rich person's, like, golf-centric country club.
Okay.
So it like, but it's like, it's weird that like to be a member of that club, you have to be invited, and the people that are invited are like the top businessmen in the world.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so it's very like, you know, traditionally it's been like all like old white dudes.
Mm-hmm.
They have invited some like minority members and women, like most famously Condoleezza Rice was invited,
right,
but
yeah.
like, you know, that like shows like what kind of like weird standards they have, you know, because.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take a black woman, but as long as she's a conservative, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so there are stuff like that. There's like also this, like, I read the biography of Ray Kroc.
Uh-huh.
And he was invited to this, like, other, like, super secret rich club when he got famous. He's the guy who, you know, franchised McDonald's and mm-hmm. made billions on it. So it's like there's these rich people, I forget what it's called, but they all meet in San Francisco every year. And they, like, go out into the woods. And they all wear togas or something, and they do all these, like, weird, like, they get drunk and, like, wasted, and they...
Hunt people with antlers?
They might have done that, like, years ago. But they mainly, there's, like, a bunch of pianos in the woods. It's, like, this little magical, like, scenario they've set up.
What?
Where they, like, play instruments, and they put on plays, and they all have to humble themselves, even though they're the most rich and powerful people in the world.
That's super weird.
Yeah, it's, like, super weird, and it's a real thing.
Uh-huh.
So it's like rich people are up to weird stuff. So Chris Claremont's like letting us into that. So anyway, back to the story.
Uh-huh.
We see Dazzler meets up with Scott again. You know, he's following up, and she makes out with him.
I didn't see that coming. I forgot that was, like, a plot point.
So Jean witnesses this, and she's crushed, obviously,
right.
in the moment.
Yeah.
And Scott's like, what?
Right. Well, so that's the question, I guess. Is Scott complicit?
I don't think so. It's one of those, like, television kisses where I feel like this only ever happens in movies and TV where a man is, like, kissed out of nowhere by a woman.
Uh-huh.
And he's really surprised. And right in that moment, you know, he's walked in on by his girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that in, like, a million movies. Uh-huh. In a Marvel movie, we saw in the Captain America movie that happens, where some, like, blonde, like, World War II woman makes out with Captain America, right? His Agent Carter walks in on him.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
Like, oh, God, you know, it's so stupid.
Yeah.
So that happens, and I kind of like Dazzler's reaction. She, like, even though she doesn't have many lines, she's got a really, like, spunky personality.
Yeah.
It's actually very reminiscent of Jem and the Holograms, yeah, characters in that show. Just the way she talks. She's like, what's that? The inevitable girlfriend? It reminds me of the Misfits a little bit.
Yeah.
What are their names? Do you remember the Misfits' names? Oh, God. Whatever. They have ridiculous names.
Yeah.
Jazzy
or something.
Yeah, something like that. And then, you know, Jean runs out and she's like, looks more like ex-girlfriend to me. So Dadler's pretty funny. But
Jean, it's not that Jean runs out. It's that, what's his name? Mastermind, like, meets her in that bar. Like, they go looking for Jean. They find her there. And then he, like, creates that illusion around her again, like in the dream.
Right.
And, like, he kisses her and she's like, oh, yes.
Right. So she's like, two can play at that game.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but she's swept back up in this weird world of fantasy. And then the X-Men, they manage to track Jean back to the Hellfire Club, and so now they're planning their invasion.
Right.
And they fly in there, and Rogue is, like, you know, peering through the window of the ceiling, and she sees Jean's about to get married to this guy, and Rogue, you know, puts a stop to this right away.
No, but he actually, like, whoever that guy is that's doing the wedding service actually finishes. He pronounces the man.
Oh, yeah.
And wife.
Oh, you mean Shaw? Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that happen? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean. It's another fake marriage that Jean's been involved in. Their second one in the show. And so the X-Men, they invade this Hellfire Club. They get into, it's a pretty, like, cool fight. The X-Men are not holding back. Mm-hmm. Like, Wolverine slashes at that pierced dude's arm. I wonder if Cyclops told them that it's a robot arm, because there's nothing that indicates that Wolverine would know it was.
Right.
So here he is, like, hacking some dude's arm off. And then Storm's, like, electrocuting people. Gambit throws a playing card right at Emma Frost's feet, and she explodes. It, like, explodes in her face. So the X-Men are, like, really being violent here.
Yeah.
And Cyclops is, you know, straight up shooting Shaw. There's a funny scene where Shaw tells Rogue, like, give me your best shot. And she really throws, like, a huge punch at his stomach. And she doesn't know that what this guy's mutant powers are.
Except, like, that he then explains it. Like,
right, yeah, he does. But the point is, like, if Rogue doesn't know what his power is, like, her fist probably would have gone through any other person's stomach, like,
right,
straight through.
Right. It's just one of those funny moments where it's, like, overly expositional, where he just, like, spells out, like, directly, like, the more you fight me, like, the more I absorb your powers, and the stronger I become. It's like, if he was really trying to beat her, it would be to his advantage to not explain that and just let her find out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But whatever.
Yeah, and then most famously, Wolverine takes on the fat guy, Leland, and Leland uses his purple gravity powers on him and, like, sinks him to the sewer basement of the Hellfire Mansion.
Right.
And that is, like...
Yeah, I remember that sequence from the comics.
Yeah, that's very famous from the comics. It ends with, like, this, like... splash image of Wolverine, like, looking up sort of at the ceiling hole with his claws out, like he's ready to get revenge. Mm. He's gonna have to save the X-Men. I don't think that image is shown in this episode. I missed it, or maybe it's in the next one, but it's very iconic. Mm. And they keep repurposing it in throughout the X-Men comic history too, because it's such a famous image. And the X-Men ends on a cliffhanger where Phoenix tells the X-Men, like, listen, I married this dude, I love him, and also I am Phoenix. She says it in a very menacing way, not in the, like, happy way she said it when we first introduced her.
Yeah.
And that's the whole episode. Wonderful entry into Dark Phoenix month, would you not say?
Yeah, jam-packed in that first one.
Yeah, I mean, a pretty good summation of the classic comic storyline. Like we said, not perfect. It can't, like, capture all the nuance, but still good enough.
Yeah.
And very exciting. And so now, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the episode I wanted to talk briefly about the two news items that are very X-Men related. I won't drab on too long about them. But basically, the Dark Phoenix, like, press tour hit for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I checked it out, and I was, you know... I mean, I'm not, like, gonna outright say, like, I'm not looking forward to this movie, but I'm kind of not looking forward to this movie. You know, the promotional stills looked a little, like, not great.
Yeah.
I'm not the biggest fan of Sophie Turner, who is playing Jean Grey.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, a weird note she mentioned in the article saying, like, I gave up partying because I didn't want to get hangovers. I really wanted to concentrate on this role. I know what it means to comic book fans. And that, and I was reading, I was like, what? None of that makes sense. Like, so your party, are you saying that, like, on the last movie, your partying affected your acting or something? Or that is this, you're typically when you have a job as an actor, you go out partying and you're hungover all the time and you suck? I
mean, yeah.
So that was bizarre.
Yeah.
Also, it's being directed by this guy named Simon Kinberg, who it's his first directorial debut, but he's like written a lot of the X-Men movies with Bryan Singer and crew and company. And, you know, they keep making this one point that, like, this guy, oh, he's such a visionary. Like, he's a real visionary. He finally gets to his vision. And they keep going on about, like, what an X-Men visionary he is. And I just, I'm like, really? This guy? You know, it's like, I mean, this is his first time directing.
We'll
so, yeah, we'll see. Maybe. We'll get to that in a second. But, so, I don't know. There's, like, the cast and crew seem to really be on board with whatever they're doing with this movie. The movie is also weirdly set 10 years forward from the previous one. So the last one was set in 1982. This one's set in 1992. Mm-hmm. So they keep aging these characters by 10 years in like 3-year spans.
Yeah.
So the characters still all look like they're, you know, 20 years old, including Professor X and Magneto.
Right.
And everyone's returning. So everyone's really upset that Jennifer Lawrence is back as Mystique in a prominent role, which makes no sense because mm-hmm. that is not what the character Mystique is. And it's really stupid.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, I mean, my thing is she's just coming back for a paycheck. You know, she has something in her contract. She's a huge star. She has something in her contract. This is, the more sequels she agrees to, the more money they have to pay her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing she's getting, like, upwards of $20 million for this, probably. Something close to that.
Yeah.
So I guess she wants, like, another house or something. So, and because she's expressed that she doesn't even like the X-Men movies or that she's tired of them.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just so, you know, but she'll be back, too. I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously going to see the movie. I mean, you're going to see it, too, with me, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to be there.
Yeah.
It's coming out next year, like 1 year from now, next November. I don't know. I mean, I guess when we see
it's
the trailer...
The same thing. I think it's the same thing that we, like, keep on saying about all these, like, superhero movies. It's like, the Marvel movies are always good. Like,
the X-Men more... movies are hit and miss.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, the DC movies, by and large, are, like, not that good.
Yeah.
But still, it's like, the whole thing is really, like... building up to, like, lose its audience at some point. Like, all of us are like, oh, I'm tired of, like, paying all this money to these franchises all the time.
It's repetitive. And this is the second telling of the Phoenix story in film.
Yet we, like, keep going back to see them. I don't know. I feel like we've had this conversation before.
Yeah, we have.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not super thrilled, but who knows? Maybe it'll be okay, good. But then, okay, so leading to the second bit of news, this movie, like, who even knows what's going to happen with this movie now? I mean, I guess it's being made, but... Disney is reportedly set to buy 20th Century Fox next week for upwards of $60 billion, mm-hmm. which is insane. And that has a lot of really bad, like, implications for the future of Hollywood and monopolization of things
mm-hmm.
because there's not that many big studios to begin with, and Disney's, like, flat out buying one of them, so it'll go down from, like, 6 studios to 5 or whatever the number is.
Yeah.
So that's not good. And it's not good when these mega corporations, you know, are creating monopolies, so to speak, and they control all your creative options. I mean, part of this deal, too, would be Disney would be buying, like, Fox's share of Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
And that would essentially just take care of their streaming service that they want to launch. They wouldn't need to launch one. They would just have Hulu.
Yeah.
And, selfishly, I like it because it means the X-Men and Fantastic Four would be joining the MCU, and I, you know, to me, Marvel's never been complete. I'm one of these guys that really wanted that to see happen. To me, it's not Marvel without mutants, without the X-Men, without the Fantastic Four and all those villains.
Yeah,
and you can't, and you know, like the whole magic of Marvel as a cinematic thing has been that they've managed to take their B characters, Iron Man, Captain America. You know, Ant-Man, and they've turned them into, like, superstars.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine what they could do with their actual properties. You know, now they've got Spider-Man. We really like that movie. But the X-Men are like the ultimate prize. Mm-hmm. You know, the X-Men really started the whole like comics revival of the 90s. It led to the cartoon, which led to the movies, which led to the superhero explosion we know today. I mean, the X-Men have always been the real stars. They've been put in the back seat, though, in recent years because Marvel's just been killing it with their other properties. And Fox, like, you know, it's kind of like hit or miss with their attempts at the X-Men. And they're also, and Fox has always been notoriously cheap, too, like I said, with the X-Men movies. So, you know, they, like, whereas Marvel's, like, putting, like, $200 million in Thor 3, of all things, and it looks amazing. And, you know, X-Men 10 looks, like, potentially crappy, at least to me, so mm-hmm. far. So, you know, I'll be excited if and when this goes down. It's not a guarantee yet. I think it's probably going to happen. Disney's obsessed. They want to control all their properties. And, you know, I mentioned on Facebook, like, there's just so many amazing possibilities they could do with X-Men movies. Like, most notably, I'd love to see, like, an X-Woman franchise or film. Where it's just, like, it's X-Men, but it's just women characters. You get Storm, Rogue, not the lame Anna Paquin Rogue, but, like, the comic book cartoon Rogue we know. You know, Kitty Pryde, Jean Grey. That could just be a team.
Nah, I wouldn't like to see that.
What? Really?
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
It has, like, too much potential to go wrong, you know?
Like, that's like Wonder Woman times 10, you know what I mean? Or whatever. Like, that would be so cool.
To me, it's like...
And they've never done Storm and Rogue right, really, in these movies. Like, this is a chance to, like, have all these amazing female superheroes.
I don't like the idea of, like, making it female-centric, like, purposefully, though.
Well, I just want to say, this is just my idea. This is not something they're going to do.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
So you don't like my idea. Fine.
No, sorry.
All right, other ideas, I mean, whatever. You know, like, I want to see...
I just mean, like, look at Ghostbusters, you know what I mean? It was, like, so hyped up as so,
yeah,
like,
but I mean, that's,
you know,
like,
feminism or whatever. Yeah. It's an all-female cast, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I just see, like, the potential for things to really go wrong because, like, just, like, having an all-female cast or, like, female-centric
but
movie doesn't, like, guarantee that the quality is good. It's just, like, a gimmick, you know?
Ghostbusters made no sense because Ghostbusters was not... like a franchise. It was a goofy idea by a bunch of comedians from the 80s.
Yeah.
That was really awesome.
Right.
And then their own sequel wasn't good.
Right.
Even though I referenced it in this episode and I actually dearly love it. But whatever. The point is, like, it, like, to have an all-female cast of Ghostbusters was just like a weird gimmick in a way. The X-Men legitimately have these characters with long histories and, like,
that's
amazing
true.
Characterizations.
And if they chose...
You could just do it and not even, like, make a big deal about it.
But it... It would be anyway, though, if it was, like, based on a whole ton of, like, female characters from X-Men. The way that they could get away with it, I think, and not have it be so, like, on the nose,
yeah.
would be to, like, pick one or two of the... Like, take, like, Rogue and Storm as an example,
yeah.
like you said, right?
Yeah.
Like, you make a movie around a storyline that features the two of them heavily, and then you still have all of your ancillary characters, like all the regular X-Men that you would see,
yeah.
but you, like, focus the storyline on, like, character development of Storm and Rogue and on, like, the development of the friendship
yeah.
relationship
I mean,
between
that's
the
really what
them.
I want the
you
Storm
I mean?
And Rogue friendship movie.
But yeah, like, that I would want to see, but if it's really, it's like...
But I also want Kitty Pryde, and
yeah,
I want...
Yeah, but it's like pushing the agenda
Rachel
too
Summers.
Hard, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I
like,
love
then you
Kitty
make
Pryde.
Another movie that's about Kitty Pryde
right,
and her
yeah,
backstory,
guess,
and,
yeah.
you know...
That's another thing dropped from this Dark Phoenix saga is one of the best things about the comics is they introduced Kitty Pryde in the midst of all this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like another great new character that they knocked a home run out with.
Yeah.
And so Kitty Pryde is not in the series. But yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of possibilities, though. You get the Silver Surfer can be done correctly.
Uh-huh.
Galactus, you know, you could introduce all that stuff in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Then you finally get the Fantastic Four, which I'm almost certain Marvel would do correctly compared to Fox, who has blown it every time.
Yeah.
Then you could do, like, and you could just start weaving in the X-Men characters with the Marvel characters. Like, for instance, you could have the Wolverine Captain America World War II flashback movie story. That is famously done in this series, this
mm-hmm.
cartoon series. And, like, that would be awesome as a movie. You could do, the thing I always wanted to do, I always mention is, like, the thing from Fantastic Four versus the Hulk disaster movie,
mm-hmm.
where the two of them are just fighting in New York City. It's like, and that was a comic famous, too, from the 60s with Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
Mm-hmm.
The Thing versus the Hulk. I mean, there's, like, a million endless possibilities. So, but my ultimate question is, in the meantime, 20th Century Fox has a whole slew of X-Men related movies, like in production, like in the can or planned. Mm-hmm. For instance, New Mutants is coming out soon. It's like a horror movie. Mm-hmm. Deadpool 2 is like finished. That's coming out. Mm-hmm. And also this Dark Phoenix movie. I don't know if it's finished, but it's like almost finished. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are the, if X-Men, I mean, if Disney buys X-Men tomorrow or buys Fox tomorrow, which very well might be, mm-hmm. like what happens to these movies? Does Disney say, okay, we control it now, sorry, we're canceling these movies, or... It's just so weird, because you know they want to get their, like, Kevin Feige's handprints on it and fold them into the MCU right away. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know, it'd be kind of awkward, like, what they would do, or how they would even consider these films going forward.
Yeah.
Because, like, why else are they spending, you know, they're spending $60 billion because they're getting the whole Fox, like, entertainment apparatus, including FX... You know, FXX, like The Simpsons, they'd be getting Family Guy.
Yeah.
Like The X-Files. So it's not just Marvel stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it is Marvel related.
Yeah.
Because they want to make the ultimate, like, juggernaut of comic book hero movies.
No pun intended.
Yeah. Hey, you could have the juggernaut, too.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. Like, I think if it was up to me, I would just, like, if I was buying 20th Century Fox next week, I would cancel the X-Men movie right away, even though they're, like, almost done with it. Or I would just radically go into reshoots. I'd spend all the money into fixing it and making it, like, good. But who knows? Maybe it is good.
Maybe.
Anyway, that's all my blathering I have on this. Some interesting times ahead of us. Dark Phoenix month, an intriguing time. And that's all I got. So let's say our goodbyes. Follow me on Twitter, at Willie Simpson. Join the Facebook X-Men Task Group. Just search out X-Men Task Podcast on Facebook. It'll come right up. Ask to join a member. We've got new members joining every week. We're real excited to have them. Some fun, interesting conversations going on. And also follow X-Men Task on Twitter. Buy Eric Liewald's book, previously on X-Men. Sonia, what do you have to plug for us here as we say goodbye?
Nothing.
Okay, very good. Good night, everybody.
Good night.